It is those who believe, those armed with certitude, ignorance, and fear, who are driving the Muslims and the West toward a collision that will be disastrous for both. The challenge for us all is to be thinkers rather than believers.
Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Sandra Mackey is an award-winning and highly regarded expert on Middle Eastern culture and politics. We're really glad that she's back in Charlottesville, where she both taught at St. Anne's Belfield School and also earned a master's in international relations at the University of Virginia. She tells me that she actually came here to study because of Dr. Ramazani, who is here with us today, and was her inspiration for studying the Middle East. On the university level, she is also taught both at Georgia State University and as a visiting scholar in the Woodrow Wilson Department of Government and Foreign Affairs here at the University of Virginia. Sandra Mackey has written widely on the Middle East. In addition to numerous magazine articles and op-ed pieces in leading journals and newspapers, she's published seven books. In 1987, The Saudis, Inside the Desert Kingdom. In 1992, Passion and Politics, The Turbulent World of the Arabs. In 1996, The Iranians, Persia, Islam, and the Soul of a Nation. And in 2003, The Reckoning, Iraq, and the Legacy of Saddam Hussein. She's recently published her second book specifically on Lebanon. Her 1989 Lebanon, Death of a Nation has now been followed by A Mirror of the Arab World, Lebanon in Conflict, which she will be signing after her forum. Please welcome Sandra Mackey.
Thank you, George. It's a great pleasure to be back in Charlottesville. The years I spent here, and I won't tell you how many years ago that was, were some of the best of my life. It was during that time that I was both a student and a teacher. And to testify to that, I am really delighted to see R.K. Ramazani and his lovely wife, Nesta. Rui is probably the best teacher I ever had, and he has continued to play a role of teacher and mentor in my life. I have always known that Rui, no matter how busy he is, won't take some time to answer one of my frantic questions that has arisen as I've been trying to write something, and patiently then directs me through the tangled facts and clarifying conflicting opinions and interpretations. Most of all, he has shared his incredible insight into the region about which I am writing. Also in the audience today is Paige O'Neill Gilliam and some of the girls I taught at St. Anne's School just down the road. Pamma Malone, the driving force of St. Anne's, is also here. It was in the 60s that Pam conceived a course on 20th century history designed to push students to look at the world beyond the United States and Europe. I mean, this was revolutionary at the time. Well, as the teacher of this course, Paige and her classmates, another of whom is here, and also another faculty member who was there at the time, and I must admit that some of the girls in my classes, and some of the most eager students as far as off-campus activities were boarders. And they gleefully followed me to the university for those fierce debates on Vietnam that were raging in the late 60s. Remember any of that, Paige? But I really failed to make a connection between past and present by enticing you girls on a field trip to meet Dr. Lee at the medical school. Dr. Lee had not only performed the autopsy on the Chinese revolutionary leader Sun Yat-sen, but had his cancerous gallbladder stored in a jar on a jumbled shelf in his pathology lab. And all your reaction was, ah, I don't want to. Well, this act of remembering gives me a lot of pleasure, but it also has a purpose. This morning, I want to, more than give you a lecture or a speech, I really want to have a conversation, hopefully to perhaps give you a different way to think about things that I think we all, in the last number of years, have thought about every day. It's interesting, I think, that my experiences in Charlottesville and this balancing act of the academic life in Cobble Hall with earning a living at St. Anne's essentially charted my life as a writer. I have written 6 books on the Middle East. All are directed at non-specialist readers. And let me define those as the educated, engaged, largely neglected American who is aware of the inescapable connection between the United States and the rest of the world. These people tend to be sentenced to a wasteland between the perimeters of the scholarly work of the university and the largely shallow realm of journalism. What I've been about the last 20 plus years is to gather the work of the scholars and shape it into a narrative that helps the man or woman, quote, on the street, to grasp the historic and cultural context in which today's political challenges in the Arab world are grounded. I've been successful at this largely because Rui Ramazani, William Quant, Ambassador Nathaniel Howell, Abdullah C. Sachedina of the University of Virginia, and other noted academics around the country have been willing to sit down with me and to talk to me about how I shape the issues that Westerners need to understand about that vital region between Europe and Asia. Why do I feel that this is so important? In the United States, there is an alarming lack of knowledge and understanding about foreign countries and cultures. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But maybe I have some figures that might really bring home how bad this is. In 2006, the Roper Polling Organization surveyed American high school students in a study funded by National Geographic. Listen to what it unearthed. 63% of American teenagers cannot find Iraq or Saudi Arabia on the map. Now, that's 3 years after the invasion of Iraq. 75% cannot find Iran or Israel. 88% cannot find Afghanistan. 75% don't know that Indonesia's population is overwhelmingly Muslim, making it the most populous country in the Islamic world. Figures get a little better when you look at the population of China. Only 45% of American secondary school students do not know that China's population is four times that of the United States. Well, the depressing thing is, I think, that it can be assumed that these numbers are not much better among adults, that obviously they improve somewhat, but there still is an abysmal ignorance out there about the really facts of particularly the Middle East. Some argue, and I think justifiably so, that this knowledge gap has become so bad that it borders on becoming a national security issue. Now, we all know many of the reasons. As I say, I'm not necessarily telling you things you don't know. I'm just encouraging you to think about them perhaps a little differently. The reality that reading and discussion of complex topics in the pressures of everyday life is difficult. Everybody is busy. Everybody is stressed. Everybody is pushed. You can always defer to take the time to really grapple with something that by its very nature is difficult. We've also had long years of neglect of geography and social studies instruction in elementary and secondary schools. And then, of course, there's everyone's favorite villain, which is television. Today, most Americans get all or most of their news from television. And with the ownership of the three major networks in the hands of corporate conglomerates, the accountants, with no commitment to the value of good journalism, have closed expensive bureaus abroad. And with the exception of CNN, cable news organizations do not staff their overseas bureau. Do not staff overseas bureaus. Instead, they depend on information that comes from the wire services. Consequently, the role of a reporter on the beat who can put events into context is gone. Today, a star quality personality flies into Kosovo or Baghdad or Kabul with a crew carrying lights, cameras, sound equipment, and the ever-present powder puff to cover a breaking event with what amount to sound bites. Then they fly on to the next story and the next and the next. Networks and most newspapers justify this poor coverage of international affairs by claiming there is no demand for international news by the public. The result is that the these issues that are crucial to the national interest essentially wind up as jokes on Jay Leno, Stephen Colbert, and Jon Stewart. The knowledge pool has gotten so low that the military is now running courses for the troops on history, anthropology, and culture designed for trips destined for Iraq, Afghanistan, the Balkans, and elsewhere. Surprisingly, though, or maybe not surprisingly, these are proving hugely successful, and the demand for them within the military from the people on the ground is increasing. This perhaps demonstrates, as nothing else, the reality that much of the public is interested in the rest of the world. I talk to groups all over the country, and I know how frustrated people are by the dearth of credible information and informed discussion about a whole list of issues that, of course, begins with Iraq. Well, that brings me then to my new book, Mirror of the Arab World, Lebanon in Conflict. This is not a book about Lebanon per se. Rather, it is a primer, and I say that word, it is a primer that seeks to teach non-specialists how to think about the Arab world by using Lebanon as a case study. Okay, who's the first person in the room who's going to jump up and challenge me that Lebanon cannot be a model or a case study for the Arab world? Granted, I'll give you that, it has the largest Christian population in the region. And these are Christians who actually exercise significant political power. It's located on the western edge of the Arab world. Consequently, it is the most cosmopolitan and worldly country in the region. I mean, just look at Beirut, sort of the sin city of the Arab world. There is a sizable percentage of the Lebanese population that deny they are even Arabs. They're Phoenicians or they're Greeks or they're whatever, but they definitely do not consider themselves Arabs and generally prefer to speak French rather than Arabic. And even the Lebanese who do identify themselves as Arabs often consider themselves culturally superior to non-Lebanese Arabs. So Lebanon is a distinct country in this region. But Lebanon is, no matter how many contradictory facts there are, is by culture and attitude an Arab country. That question actually was settled in the 1975-1990 Civil War. Now, Lebanon, despite its unique characteristics, is a useful microscope under which to examine the Arab world. Why? Well, it is the most transparent society of all of those in the Arab world. It has had a pretty open press. It has had a lot of political discussions, had a measure of what we might call democracy. So it is transparent. Its endemic problems, if you look at them in certain respects, are the problems of other Arab states. And frankly, Lebanon has experienced it all. From the unwillingness of the people of a fragmented state to commit themselves to building a nation, to a 15-year-long civil war, to the destructive power of meddling foreigners, to the Sunni-Shia split, the escalating dynamic in the region. And above all, to look inside Lebanon is to also look inside Iraq. Now, urbane Lebanon on the western edge of the Arab world and tribal Iraq on the eastern edge, surprisingly, are the most similar countries in the Arab world from the standpoint of the structure of society and the historic road each is traveling. Ever since 2003, Vietnam has been bandied about as the template of the American morass in Iraq. That isn't the case. The real analogy for American foreign policy and the future of the United States presence in Iraq is Lebanon. Why do I say that? Well, there are certain characteristics of Lebanon which all countries share, particularly Iraq. But having said that, I again warn you that Iraq is not a replica of any other Arab country, nor do I claim it is. But in each of these characteristics that play out in different degrees are in different countries really contribute to an understanding of the enormous importance that they play in expanding political, in explaining political behavior. In other words, it is the dynamics of these factors and how the West reacts to them that is fueling much of the instability from Palestine to Iraq. So what are these characteristics? Well, I have chosen nine, and I have demonstrated how they have played out and continue to play out in Lebanon. The first is that Lebanon is a fragmented society where families and communal groups hold the loyalty of the person, and that the society actually operates in a tribal environment in which you have fierce competition between one group and another, based on no national interest, no economic interest, but based on communal concerns. There are artificial borders of this region that were imposed by Western colonialism that incorporate diverse regions, religion, sex, ethnicity, of people who share no common identity. We have certainly seen this for the last 5 years in Iraq. Arab countries, because of these factors, tend to be hollow states housing weak institutions that are unable to distribute political and economic power equitably, adjudicate conflicts, or to provide internal and external security. There's the origin and effects of the Palestinian question, the constant of the Arab world since 1948. There has been civil war resulting from a political system that operates as a zero-sum game, which means a win for one group means a loss for another. There is no win-win for the common good. There have been foreign powers fighting proxy wars against each other at the expense of a weak Arab state. There's the recycling of old grievances and new patterns of conflict that are a product of the inertia of traditionalism with its accompanying resistance to societal and political change. There is the rise of Shia political power, and there is, of course, militant Islam as a political ideology. The Arab world as a whole faces enormous challenges beyond these. It is like a litany. Populations in which as many as one in three is under the age of 14, inadequate or poorly designed educational systems, economies unable to create enough jobs, too little water, limited or non-existent political rights, and society struggling to define the role of women. In the West, we tend to wrap all of this up into a very tidy little package that says, oh, it's the religion. If it weren't for Islam, all of these problems would just go away. Well, of course, that's not the case. Whether it is Lebanon or Iraq, Saudi Arabia or Egypt or any country in what is defined as a civil war, the Arabs are weighted down with a range of conditions that have put them where they are today. And at the same time, they're having to grapple with the realities of a global economy and the debate on universal values. Well, they're not alone. Although escaping the burden of rigid traditionalism, the West is struggling with its own condition in the new world of globalism. The tide of history is actually washing away age seawalls, forcing the West and the Arab East into a lifeboat together. But in that boat, the Arabs and the West are engaged in the much debated conflict of civilizations, which is threatening to sink them both. Not since the Crusades have the Arabs and the West faced off so flagrantly or simplistically under the flags of culture and religion. They do so because Islam is not no longer just a religion, it is also identity. So is Christianity, particularly in the United States. In secular Europe, identity drawn from cultural aggrandizement performs the same function as religion in pitting Europeans against Muslims. It is as if two trains, one coming from Islam, the other from the West, are racing toward each other on the same track. And unfortunately, on the sidelines, watching as eager spectators are the militants of Islam, the intolerant of Christianity, and the zealots of Judaism. And because I travel on both sides of the road, I hear the hateful language that comes and goes between the two sides. We tend in the United States to hear all of the most awful things that the Muslim militants say about us. What we don't hear is the language of militant Christians are firing back at them. And I mean, these people include people like Franklin Graham. I mean, this is not, you know, just a lunatic fringe that we're talking about, but there are unbelievable, there's unbelievable language, you know, floating around on the airways and in churches and on radio, talk radio, et cetera, et cetera. That not only are very hurtful, but they're generally untrue. For instance, when you're in the United States, what you hear the militants of Islam doing is to call the faithful to jihad against the Crusaders and Jews. When you're in the Arab world, what you hear is televangelists like the Reverend Ron Parsley, who fills the airways proclaiming that the United States cannot, quote, fulfill its divine purpose until we understand our historic conflict with Islam. And the ultra-nationalists of the Israeli state scream at moderates in their own population, hatch a plot, it shall be foiled, agree on action, it shall not proceed, for God is with us. Nearly 1,000 years ago, the Syrian poet Osama bin Mundek wrote that most people divide the Arab Middle East into three unequal parts: Muslim, Christian, and Jew. He divided it into only two parts: those who believe and those who think. Let me say, those who believe and those who think. It is those who believe, those armed with certitude, ignorance, and fear, who are driving the Muslims and the West toward a collision that will be disastrous for both. The challenge for us all is to be thinkers rather than believers. And that's why I think it's important to write for the general public. Thank you.
Both thinkers and believers are invited to ask questions of Sandra Mackey. If those who would like to ask questions would queue up in the back with Christina Lopez-Gattardi, we will take as many questions as we have time for. And just looking around the room, there's some people with deep expertise in the Middle East and deep interest, and so I expect there'd be some good questions. Christina, would you like to open the conversation?
Ms. Mackey, given the level of current political instability and the stalemate that continues to surround the presidential elections, if you were to type up a memo to the new president when he or she is incoming, what three recommendations would you put forth?
Oh, you asked really easy questions. Well, the first thing, obviously, is there are no good solutions in Iraq, only bad choices and worse choices. I think we've got to face that there is no, quote, clean victory, whatever that means, in Iraq, that we really need to address this with a lot more care and thought than we did when we decided to invade Iraq. Secondly, I would say that this really needs to be a regional solution. And because, as Rui has so often said, the Persian Gulf isn't an ocean, it's a lake, and it's got an east side and it's got a west side. And that is really where U.S. vital interests are. I mean, you know, let's face it, it is about oil. And this is the reason why it has so many ramifications for not only the United States, but of course the industrialized world, that we've got to move toward the goal of bringing stability to the Persian Gulf. And that stability has got to be found with all the neighbors bordering that region. It's not going to be easy, it's extremely difficult, and it's extremely complex. And third, I would say that, you know, the word understanding is the most overused word in the English language, and, you know, it in some ways it's quite trite. But it really isn't, because I think what I was really wanting to engage you to think about today is that there really are two sides of this conflict between the West and the Islamic world. And we certainly have grievances against the Islamic world, but they also have legitimate grievances against us. If we can just come to the point that we realize, you know, that this is the same boat. We are in the same boat, and we both got to paddle. And of course, that means, you know, that is the sort of thing that is really, really difficult in achieving, because you have to have a leader, number one, who recognizes what needs to be done, and the persuasive powers to convince the American people that we need to look for a win-win situation rather than plain zero-sum politics.
Could you comment on the power and the influence of Hezbollah and how it's increased over time? I understand that in 2005, they won, I believe, 10% of the parliamentary elections. So what's happened since this time? If you could comment on that.
Yes, I was in Lebanon in October of 2005. And my primary purpose in going was to really look at the organization and the passion surrounding Hezbollah. And it was a very interesting experience. And obviously, like any political group, there are many, many faces of it. Let me back up and just say that Hezbollah really does have the characteristics of hospitality. I mean, they can't break with that. I mean, they can be, you know, saying all sorts of really ugly things to you, but yet if you're in their presence, there's a certain amount of hospitality that is expected. And I am probably the only person in this room who owns a Hezbollah baseball cap, which was given to me by one of my hosts. I think that one way to look at Hezbollah, and as I say, you know, there are many facts. Some of them are theological, some of them are political, you know. To me, the most important characteristic to think about with Hezbollah, and I think this is definitely applicable to Muqtada al-Sadr in Iraq, is that both men represent social revolutions. Hezbollah really is what most people see in Hezbollah is the empowerment of the Shia, particularly the Shia lower classes. And Hezbollah has done some very good things in Lebanon as far as social action is concerned. They do obviously have an agenda to drive the influence of Israel out of Lebanon. But if you look at their social programs, you can see why people are attracted to them. Well, certainly the same thing is true in Iraq. And Muqtada al-Sadr is pushing a social revolution. And we, as Americans, with 140,000 plus troops there, really have to realize the social content of what al-Sadr is doing, not just that he is an insurgent or he's wanting to drive the United States out. The challenge of al-Sadr is how do you incorporate his followers and their concerns into this political process? And I think right now we're not doing a really good job of that from the standpoint, I mean, it's incredibly important to get rid of these militias so that a central government can function. But to go after the Mahdi army and not go after the Badr Brigade, that doesn't work. So, I think that we really need to think about that aspect of both of these movements and how you, particularly in Iraq, incorporate the concerns of those people into the body politic.
Ms. Mackey, my name is Phil Williams, and I'm proud parent of two St. Anne's Belfield graduates. I think I've also had the shortest teaching career at St. Anne's on record, but I did actually teach world history and AP U.S. history for a number of weeks to help out a sick teacher at the time. I wanted to say that the work you're doing aimed at the audience that you've targeted is very commendable and very necessary, and I applaud you for that. I would also like to say that in another forum, I would suggest that there are perhaps such a thing as thinking believers, and I think they're thinking believers on both sides.
Certainly.
And finally, what I wanted to ask you, I was quite curious. You spoke of Professor Sachedina and Ruhi Ramazani and people like that here in the United States who've helped to shape a great deal of your thinking in the Middle East. I was curious about your own travels in the Middle East, receptions that you had as a woman, and how they might have varied in the urbane society of Lebanon versus other societies, Arab societies further east. Thank you.
Well, I've sort of been through the perils of Pauline over the years because the way I do my research is really getting out and going into the homes, in the schools, etc., of the ordinary people. I mean, I've interviewed political leaders. You know, I've done my share of that. But, you know, you can almost predict what they're going to say. And when you really go out and spend a day with a family or a neighborhood, and you sit down and you have a meal or you have several cups of tea, that's when you really find out who people are and what they're thinking and where they want to go. I've had some great experiences. Let me go back to the Hezbollah situation in Lebanon. As I said, I was there principally to connect with Hezbollah. I mean, I was not, again, not really aiming at the leadership as much as I was the membership. And I thought it was just absolutely critical that I go to Baalbek, which is in the Bekaa Valley, which is kind of the ceremonial place among for Hezbollah. And I was talking to a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, who's senior editor at CNN, and I said, I'm going to Lebanon, and I'm going to do this, and this, and I'm going to Baalbek. Well, he just freaks out. He says, you can't go to Baalbek. It's too dangerous. I said, what do you mean it's too dangerous? He said, oh, if you go, you've got to at least, you know, you got to wear body armor, and a helmet, and da-da-da-da-da, you know. So I said, well, I don't think that's going to be necessary. But this gets me back to talking about the limitations of television. Obviously, I mean, I've been places where the TV crews arrive and suddenly the whole atmosphere changes. Everybody becomes a TV star, and what do you want me to say to get me on television? We see that in the States, but you see it in Iran, you see it in Iraq, you see it in Syria. I mean, it's universal. So, but as a little lady in Reeboks and jeans, I can just wander around. I'm so non-threatening that I can find out all sorts of things that the news reporters can't find out. And it's a real advantage being a woman reporting on this area, because one of the things you get to do is you get to go into the world of women, and that's where you really find out what's going on. So, I have found it to be a real advantage. And actually, again, talking about, some of my personal experiences, I went to Iraq in October of 2004, and I was guest of the 1st Infantry Division, because the commander, General John Batiste, was wanting me to see what they were doing in, quote, nation building. And he's a savvy fellow, and he was doing all the right things. But they said, well, we'll set up appointments for you. Who do you want to see? Well, one of the things I wanted to do, I went into Balad, I went to Tikrit, I went to Kirkuk, I went up to Sulaymaniyah. And one of the things I wanted to do in Sulaymaniyah, which is in the Kurdish area, was to go to this art school. The American military said, you want to go to an art school? Yes, I want to go to this art school. I had found out when I was in Iraq in 99, when Saddam was still in, and of course, you know, the control over people wandering around like I was doing was very tight, that because I have a genuine interest in art, and because Iraq had quite an important contemporary history movement in the 50s and 60s, I wanted to see what had happened to it. So I went to the art school in Baghdad. And it was amazing that with my, quote, minder standing next to me, I would talk to these artists about their work and all the things they could tell me that were not acceptable in the eyes of the minder, but were acceptable in terms of their work. It was just a treasure trove of information. So when I went to Sulaymaniyah, I did the same thing with this Kurdish art school that had been there for quite some time. And one of the questions I asked was, well, what are the symbols of the new Iraq? And I said, oh, well, there are no symbols of the new Iraq. I mean, we can't possibly devise anything that incorporates the Kurds with what the Arabs are. You know, they're so far behind us, and they're, you know, culturally so inferior to us and so forth. And I said, well, do you see yourselves as serving as a conduit of the new Iraqi state by actually bringing people from other parts of Iraq to teach them art techniques? Oh, be absolutely useless. They can't understand it, you know. Well, I mean, this sounds kind of funny, but I mean, in the context of that discussion that kept repeating itself over several hours, you really got a look at what the real problems are in trying to build a common nationality in Iraq. So that's what I do, is I go out and talk to these ordinary people, and I think that's where you find out the most.
Hi, Ms. Mackey. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dalia Mortada. I'm a political science major and a Middle East studies major, and I do appreciate you being here. I did want to ask you, you're using Lebanon as a model in comparison to Iraq, and I'm glad to hear that because in my studies I found that with the similarities and sectarian differences, rather, and you have the Kurdish people in Iraq, and you have the Druze in Lebanon, you have the Sunni and the Shiites, and you have the Christians. I've heard scholars say that Iraq won't become a nation until it erupts into a civil war, just like Lebanon did. Can you see a future in Iraq without a civil war, or do you think that's a necessary evil for it to finally calm down, I guess you could say?
Well, you know, if you look at Lebanon, and I think this is where the similarity, you know, really does show itself, is that even with the civil war, Lebanon really hasn't calmed down. I mean, it has quote calmed down as far as violence is concerned, but they really haven't made a lot of progress in really coming together and forming this union that everyone is willing to buy into. And part of the reason for that is that Lebanon is really used and is being used right now as an arena for a proxy war. I mean, we've got Israel and Iran and the United States and Syria all back into Lebanon. Maybe they don't have troops per se, but they certainly are feeding in money, and then you bring in the Saudis who are, you know, funding some of the Sunnis and so forth. So whether Iraq has a civil, I don't think a civil war in Iraq is necessary for them to move to a unified nation. But at the same time, even with the civil war and with the change of power relationships, it does not necessarily achieve that either. And it's really, and I think, you know, in Iraq you see the same players there who are from out, you know, they are not Iraqis, they're foreign powers, they're playing out their own agendas there, and the Iraqis are being victimized by this as well as their own internal conflicts. So to me it's rather dismal about what the future holds in Iraq and also in Lebanon, because I think Lebanon, you know, I think most people, and I would be interested in what your opinion is incredibly fragile right now, and it could really break out into war again. And the configuration of that war really will depend a lot on which foreign powers become involved and how they become involved.
Yes, Sandra Fadel, I have two questions. One, you mentioned the fact that religion, it isn't just religion. You touched on the haves and have-nots that are involved in this. Would you comment on Abu Dhabi and Dubai and all that's going on there, and Western development and Tiger Woods playing golf there, and how this might feed in? What is the reaction and feelings in the other parts of the Arab world, and how does that play out? And secondly, would you comment on President Carter's visit to the area?
Okay. Well, let me address the Emirates first. I was in the Persian Gulf a couple of years ago, and I actually had been there since the late 70s, early 80s, when my husband and I were living in Saudi Arabia. I mean, you know, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I'd seen the pictures. I knew, you know, but this is Disney World on the Persian Gulf. And there's Dubai particularly, it's just not real. And you just wonder how much longer is this going to be able to go on? If nothing else, is the whole place going to sink from the weight of all the buildings? But so I think that's the negative side of it, is that there's not a real authenticity that you feel in the Emirates. It's a created atmosphere. And the fact that, I mean, one of the things I thought about was that all the Indians who have been working in that area for 30, 40 years, and they don't have citizenship, you know, are they at some point just going to rise up and take the place over? On the positive side, you have had some good leadership in this area among some of these little sheikdoms. And in a sense, in some ways, the Emirates have been kind of sending out a beacon out there to the rest of the Arab world about how you might make this transition to modernization. Now, of course, you're talking about a country with practically unlimited resources, and that makes a huge difference. You've got populations that are quite small. You know, all of these things play in. But, you know, there are some positive signs about responsible governance that you're seeing in the Emirates that we hope would go on. Okay, Jimmy Carter's visit. You know, when you're in your 80s and have been a president of the United States, you know, you can kind of go do what you want to do. And I admire Carter for doing what he's been doing. I think the whole situation with Hamas has been incredibly unfortunate, because the United States pushed the Palestinian Authority into having this election, because the United States was going to promote democracy in the Middle East. Hamas won, and we refused to deal with it. Now, look, you can't have it both ways. And if Hamas was actually elected by the Palestinian people, which the international observers felt it was a reasonably legitimate election, what were those people? Why were those people voting for Hamas? Gotta go talk to them. You gotta figure out how you address their grievances, if you can, and how you get them into the process. And instead, U.S. policy is just to not talk to Hamas, keep the Palestinians hemmed in this hell that is Gaza, until the whole place just explodes. Now, having said that, again, this is not easy, and Hamas is a difficult organization, and they have people who, again, they don't. Most of the people in Gaza, unfortunately, don't have very good education. So you're dealing with a population that will tend toward the easy answers, the simplistic answers, and so forth. So I guess I'll leave it there, because it's both we've got to talk to Hamas, and we've got to figure out how to get them into the political process, and we've got to figure out how to sell it to Israel, or we've got to impose some sort of agreement that tells the Israelis the United States will do this much, but no more.
My name is Judy Featherston. I don't have a great knowledge, but I do have a great thirst for knowledge about the Middle East. And the previous guest more or less asked my question, but I had something specific about it, and that is Condoleezza Rice's statement that it is totally wrong to talk to Hamas because they are the impediment to peace. And I believe that was her pretty much exact quote. And that just blew my mind. It seems like beyond fuzzy logic into the area of stupid logic. I just would be interested in your reaction to what she said. That's one question. And my second question is on the topic of democracy. It has always seemed to me that our current administration has foisted this patented in-the-box idea about democracy on Iraq, and that seems to be the thrust of when he speaks to us, is giving democracy to Iraq. And my question is this a good goal? Is this a realistic goal, or is it a giant misunderstanding of the culture?
Okay.
Thank you.
We're running out of time, so let me just do two quick responses to those. When Condoleezza Rice says the greatest impediment to peace is Hamas, the other great impediment to peace is the settlers' movement in Israel. And so you've got two enormous impediments to peace there, and we've got to talk about both of them. Your other question about democracy. Yeah. You cannot come in and just impose a quote democracy on another culture, particularly one in which you really, doesn't have any real experience with democracy. They have a little bit, but not a whole lot. And I think one of the great mistakes, among others, of American policy in Iraq has been saying that we're going to establish democracy in Iraq. Why on earth we didn't say we are going to create the atmosphere for representative government? Because that's really what we're talking about. Because in the elections of December 2005, it wasn't any surprise that everybody lined up to vote for however their sheikh or their religious leader told them to vote. I mean, that person is responsible for the welfare of his community. So, of course, you're going to vote that way. And the fact it came as such a surprise of how these elections, it blows my mind about the lack, again, the lack of understanding of what you're dealing with. And you've got to have representative government. It's got to come up from the culture within which it's operating. And the way that the Constitution was written for Iraq and so forth and so on, it essentially institutionalized this. One thing I think it's going to be interesting to watch is how the provincial elections in Iraq work out in October, because that may give us a little more. If they go well, that's a good sign for the future, but there's still a lot of work to be done, and the Iraqis have got to do it, not us.
Sandra Mackey will be signing copies of her book on Lebanon out front, and so let me ask everyone to stay in their places until she can leave the room, and those who would like to talk with her or purchase the book can meet her outside. Please join me in thanking Sandra Mackey.